A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and I think it hits a nerve for a lot of people. He's asking about clever ways to make small apartment living feel less claustrophobic without just throwing out everything you own. Specifically, how to keep things tidy and organized, surfaces clean, and make better use of limited storage so clutter doesn't take over your life. The tension here, I think, is that most advice assumes you're ready to go full minimalist and own 3 shirts and a houseplant. Daniel's asking what you do when you actually have stuff.
That's the real world question, right? Because most people aren't living in those Instagram apartments with 1 bookshelf and a single monstera leaf in a vase. They've got winter coats, kitchen gadgets, kids' toys, paperwork, sentimental items. They're not going to Marie Kondo into oblivion.
Although I do think my leaf collection would look excellent in an Instagram apartment.
Your leaf collection is a pile of dried foliage you keep in a shoebox under your bed, corn. That's not decor, that's kindling.
It's ancestral.
It's a fire hazard. But look, the research on this has shifted in the last couple years. The old advice was always, declutter, 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 declutter. And sure, getting rid of things you genuinely don't use helps. But there's been a real move toward what some organizing professionals call density thinking. How do you make the cubic volume you have work harder, rather than just apologizing for owning things?
I like that. So instead of feeling guilty about the winter coat, you figure out where the winter coat lives when it's not winter coat season.
I want to flag something before we dive in. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
Welcome to the show, DeepSeek. Don't make me sound too slow.
Too late for that. So let's start with the vertical space problem, because that's where most small apartments leave the biggest wins on the table. The average ceiling height in a Jerusalem apartment, and I'm thinking of the older buildings in our neighborhood, is around 2.7 to 3 meters. That's a lot of unused air.
Unused air is my favorite kind of air.
Sure, but it's also storage you haven't claimed yet, and I'm not talking about stacking things to the ceiling like a warehouse. There's a design principle called the golden zone, the space between about waist height and eye level. That's where your daily use items should live. Below that is for heavier, less frequently accessed things. Above eye level is for seasonal storage, things you need maybe twice a year.
The holiday decorations go up high. The daily coffee mugs stay at arm's reach, and the cast iron pan lives low because if it falls on your foot from a high shelf, you're going to the emergency room.
That's actually a legitimate safety consideration. There was a piece in Apartment Therapy that talked about how many small apartment injuries come from people overreaching for things stored too high or too deep in cabinets. The writer interviewed an ER doctor in New York who said they see a surprising number of ladder-related injuries from people trying to access top-shelf storage in their own homes. So practical organization also has a safety dimension.
That's the kind of thing nobody tells you when you're browsing storage solutions. This shelf might send you to the hospital.
The vertical strategy has to be intentional. Wall-mounted shelving that goes up, not out. Overdoor organizers aren't just for college dorms anymore. There are some well-designed ones now. And the space above kitchen cabinets? That's prime real estate for baskets with things you need maybe once a season.
I've seen people put decorative items up there, which always seemed like a missed opportunity. You're using prime hidden storage to display a vase. Nobody can actually see properly.
That's exactly the category error that drives me nuts. People confuse storage with display and then wonder why their apartment feels cluttered. Here's a concrete rule I came across. Every horizontal surface in your apartment should be either completely clear or intentionally styled. There's no middle ground. The problem in most small apartments is that surfaces become a gray zone. A little mail here, a few receipts there, a charger cable, some coins, and suddenly every surface is a low-grade anxiety generator.
The gray zone is a good way to put it. It's not quite messy enough to motivate you to clean, but it's not clean enough to feel peaceful.
That's the psychological dimension that doesn't get enough attention. There was a study out of UCLA's Center on Everyday Lives and Families that found a direct link between the density of household objects and cortisol levels in mothers. The more stuff in the visual field, the higher the stress hormone. And it wasn't about cleanliness. These were homes that were reasonably clean. It was about visual noise.
Even if everything is technically organized, if it's all visible, it's still stressing you out.
That's the finding. Which is why one of the most effective things you can do in a small apartment is reduce what the organizing world calls visual clutter. That means solid front storage instead of open shelving in some areas. It means cord management. Loose cables are one of the biggest sources of visual chaos in modern apartments. It means putting things behind doors or in opaque containers instead of clear bins.
Wait, I thought clear bins were supposed to be the solution, so you can see what's inside.
That's the trade-off. Clear bins are great for finding things quickly, but they create visual noise because you can see all the contents. Opaque bins with labels give you the same findability without the visual chaos. There's an organizing consultant named Shira Gill who calls it quiet storage. The idea is that storage should recede visually, not announce itself.
So the storage itself becomes part of the calm rather than part of the clutter.
That leads into another principle, the container concept. This comes from Dana K. White, who wrote Decluttering at the Speed of Life. The idea is that your container, whether it's a drawer, a shelf, a closet, sets the limit. You don't ask how much of this category can I own. You ask how much of this category fits in this container. And when the container is full, something has to go before something new comes in.
The container becomes the decision maker, not your emotional attachment to the 17th coffee mug.
It externalizes the limit. You're not making a value judgment about the mug. You're just acknowledging that the mug shelf holds 12 mugs, and if you want a new one, one of the 12 has to leave. It's a surprisingly effective psychological trick because it depersonalizes the decision.
I imagine that works better for some categories than others. But what about the shoebox of sentiment under my bed?
First of all, that's leaves, not sentiment. But on the actual sentiment question, you don't have to get rid of sentimental items. But you do need to give them a defined home with boundaries. A single memory box per person, for instance. When the box is full, you curate. You're not throwing away memories, you're selecting the most meaningful artifacts.
The curation framing feels more respectful than declutter your grandmother's letters.
I think that's where a lot of organizing advice loses people. It treats sentimental attachment as a problem to overcome rather than a legitimate human need. The goal isn't to own nothing. The goal is to own what matters and store it in a way that doesn't create daily friction.
Okay, so we've talked about vertical space, visual clutter, the container concept. What about surfaces? Daniel specifically mentioned keeping surfaces clean. That feels like the daily battle.
It is the daily battle. And the key insight is that surfaces don't get cluttered because people are lazy. They get cluttered because items don't have a designated home that's easier to reach than the surface itself. If your mail lands on the kitchen counter every day, it's because there's no mail processing station that's more convenient than the kitchen counter.
The solution isn't try harder to put things away. It's make putting things away the path of least resistance.
That's the entire game. There's a design principle from UX that applies perfectly. You can't change user behavior through willpower alone. You have to change the environment so the desired behavior is easier than the undesired behavior. If you want keys to not live on the dining table, you need a key hook or tray right by the door at the exact spot where you naturally set things down when you walk in.
I've noticed this in our apartment. There's a spot on the kitchen counter where mail just accumulates, and every time I walk past it, I think I should deal with that. And then I don't. Because dealing with it requires decisions, and decisions require energy, and by the time I'm walking past the mail pile, I'm usually on my way to do something else.
That's the friction problem in action. The mail pile exists because processing mail is a multi-step task. Open, read, categorize, file, shred, recycle. And none of those steps happen at the spot where the mail first lands. What you need is a mail station near the entry point, with a recycling bin and a shredder and a small file box right there. Collapse the steps into one location.
Let's talk about storage in small apartments specifically. Daniel mentioned making better use of limited storage. What are the high leverage moves?
The highest leverage move is zone-based storage. Instead of thinking about storage as, where do I put things, you think about it as, where do I use things? Items should be stored as close as possible to their point of use. Cooking utensils near the stove, not in a hallway closet. Cleaning supplies in or near the bathroom and kitchen, not all consolidated in one utility closet far from both.
Which seems obvious, but I think most people organize by category rather than by zone. All the extra toiletries go in one place, regardless of which bathroom they're used in.
Category-based storage creates a retrieval problem. You have to walk to the category location, find the item, bring it to the point of use, and then return it. That's 4 steps. Zone-based storage cuts it to 2, grab and return. Over the course of a day, those saved steps add up.
You sound like you've been reading operations research papers again.
It's basically lean manufacturing applied to the home. Toyota production system, but for your bathroom cabinet. Minimize motion waste. And I know that sounds absurdly nerdy, but it actually works.
I love that you just compared my bathroom to a Toyota factory.
Your bathroom could use some Kaizen, honestly.
I'm going to choose not to be offended by that. So zone-based storage is one high-leverage move.
Dead space activation. Every apartment has wasted cubit volume that could be storage with the right hardware. The space under the bed is the obvious one, but I'm not talking about just shoving things under there. Proper underbed storage containers on wheels with lids organized by category. The space above the refrigerator. The inside of cabinet doors, you can mount spice racks, lid holders, small baskets, the back of the bathroom door, the toe kick space under kitchen cabinets. There are actually drawers designed to fit there now.
Toe kick drawers? That's a thing?
They're shallow, maybe 4 inches high, but perfect for baking sheets, placemats, flat items that otherwise take up a whole shelf. I saw a kitchen remodel feature in Dwell magazine where they installed toe kick drawers and gained something like 6 square feet of storage in a tiny galley kitchen.
6 square feet doesn't sound like much, until you realize that's basically an entire additional cabinet's worth of space. You adjust.
That's the pattern with dead space activation. Each individual win seems small, but they compound. Underbed storage gives you maybe 8 to 10 square feet. Over cabinet space gives you another few. Door-mounted storage gives you vertical square footage. By the time you've activated 5 or 6 dead zones, you've effectively added a small closet's worth of storage to an apartment that physically didn't gain a single square foot.
It's storage arbitrage. You're capturing value. The apartment already contains, but isn't using.
None of this requires throwing anything away. You're just being smarter about where things live.
Let's talk about the tidy and organized maintenance side. Because you can set up all these systems, but if they don't survive daily life, they're just aspirational.
This is where the 10-minute reset concept is useful. At the end of each day, you spend 10 minutes, and only 10 minutes, returning things to their designated homes. Not deep cleaning, not reorganizing, just resetting. Timer set, stop when it goes off.
Why the timer? Why not just put things away until it's done?
Because, without a hard stop, the task expands to fill whatever emotional energy you have. The timer makes it a bounded commitment, which makes it psychologically easier to start. And starting is the hard part. Once you're moving, 10 minutes often ends up being enough anyway. In a small apartment, 10 minutes of focused reset covers a lot of ground.
That tracks with the behavioral science on habit formation. Small, consistent actions build more durable habits than heroic weekend cleaning binges.
BJ Fogg's work on tiny habits. Start with something so small it's impossible to fail, then build from there. A 10-minute reset is a tiny habit that punches above its weight because it's daily. Over a week, that's over an hour of tidying. Over a month, you've put in more tidying time than a monthly deep clean session, but spread out in a way that prevents the apartment from ever getting truly chaotic.
I've also found that doing the reset slowly and deliberately makes it feel less like a chore and more like a ritual. Walking through the apartment, returning things, noticing what's out of place, it's almost meditative.
That's a very corn take, but there's something to it. The reset as mindfulness practice rather than punishment. It also gives you a daily read on your space. You notice when something keeps ending up in the wrong spot, which tells you the system isn't working for that item and needs adjustment.
The reset doubles as a diagnostic.
You're not just tidying, you're gathering data on your own behavior patterns. If the mail keeps piling up in the same spot despite your beautiful new mail station, the mail station is in the wrong spot. The behavior is the truth teller.
What about surfaces? Daniel specifically mentioned keeping surfaces clean. In a small apartment, surfaces feel like they attract clutter magnetically.
There's a rule that's almost stupidly simple but surprisingly effective, the one-touch rule. When something comes into your hand, you make a decision about it right then. Mail, open it, recycle the envelope, put the bill in the bill spot. Don't set it down to deal with later. Groceries, put them away completely, don't leave the non-perishables on the counter for now. The for now pile is the enemy of clean surfaces.
The for now pile is probably responsible for half the clutter in modern civilization.
The one-touch rule works because it prevents the pile from forming in the first place. The counter-argument is that it's exhausting to make decisions constantly, which is fair. But the alternative is deferred decisions that accumulate into a much larger, more exhausting task later. The cognitive load of the pile grows over time, while the cognitive load of the immediate decision is small and then gone.
It's the interest payment on decision debt. You either pay the small decision cost now, or the compound decision cost later.
Corn, alright, let's shift to a topic I think gets overlooked, furniture. In a small apartment, your furniture choices either work for you or against you. What should people be looking for? The single biggest thing is dual-purpose furniture, but I want to be specific about what that means, because dual-purpose has become a buzzword. A true dual-purpose piece does two things well, not one thing well and one thing badly. A storage ottoman that's comfortable to sit on and holds blankets inside, that's dual-purpose. A sofa bed that's a terrible sofa and a terrible bed, that's just two bad pieces of furniture stapled together.
The sofa bed problem. I've slept on some truly hostile sofa beds in my time.
The technology has actually improved. There are some good sofa beds now, but they cost more, and people often cheap out on them because they're buying for the occasional guest rather than for daily use. My advice, if you're buying a sofa bed for a small apartment, test it as a bed before you buy it. Lie down on it. Spend 10 minutes. If it's uncomfortable after 10 minutes, imagine what it's like at 3 in the morning.
What about non-sleeping dual-purpose furniture? Desks, tables, that kind of thing.
Wall-mounted drop-leaf tables are fantastic. They fold flat against the wall when not in use and can serve as a desk, a dining table, extra counter space. Nesting tables that tuck under each other. Benches with lift-top storage. And the vertical desk concept. A narrow console table against a wall that serves as a desk during work hours and a sideboard the rest of the time.
I've seen those narrow console desks. They're basically a shelf at desk height with just enough depth for a laptop. It forces you to be disciplined about what lives on your desk, which I imagine is actually a feature, not a bug.
It absolutely is. A small desk forces you to process things rather than pile them. You can't accumulate desk clutter if there's no desk surface to accumulate on. It's the container concept applied to furniture.
What about the visual tricks? Mirrors to make rooms feel bigger, that kind of thing. Does any of that actually work, or is it just interior design folklore?
Some of it works, some of it is folklore. Mirrors do work. Placing a large mirror opposite a window effectively doubles the light in the room and creates the illusion of depth. There's actual perceptual psychology behind it. Our brains use visual cues to estimate room size, and a mirror disrupts those cues in a way that makes the space feel larger.
The mirror trick is real. What about the paint everything white? Advice?
That one's more nuanced. Light colors do reflect more light and can make a space feel airier, but an all-white apartment could also feel cold and institutional. The current thinking, and I saw a good breakdown of this from an interior designer named Anita Yokota, is that you want a light, cohesive color palette, but with texture and variation, to keep it from feeling sterile. So light walls, yes, but with some warmth in the undertone, and then textiles and art that add visual interest without adding visual noise.
Cohesive palette, but not monochrome. That makes sense.
Another visual trick with evidence behind it, exposed legs on furniture. Sofas, chairs, tables that sit on legs rather than going all the way to the floor create a sense of more floor space because you can see more of the floor. In a small room, being able to see the floor extend under and beyond the furniture makes the room read as larger.
The same square footage, but the visual perception changes based on whether the furniture blots the sightline to the floor.
It's the same principle as glass coffee tables or acrylic chairs. Transparent or leggy furniture preserves sightlines, and preserved sightlines mean your brain registers more visible space.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about the psychological dimension. You talked about the UCLA study on cortisol and visual clutter. What else do we know about how small space living affects people mentally?
There's a body of research on crowding stress, the psychological effects of perceived spatial constraint. And the key word is perceived. Two people can live in the same square footage and one feels cramped and the other feels cozy, based largely on how the space is organized and how much control they feel over their environment.
Control is the operative word there.
It's huge. When people feel like their stuff is happening to them rather than being managed by them, stress goes up. When they feel like they have systems that work, even a very small space can feel sufficient. There's a researcher at Cornell, I want to say her name is Lorraine Maxwell, who's done work on what she calls environmental competence. The idea is that your relationship with your physical space affects your overall sense of efficacy. If you can manage your small apartment well, it builds a sense of competence that carries into other areas.
Organizing your sock drawer is actually self-actualization.
I mean, you joke, but there's something to it. Not the sock drawer specifically, but the feeling of, I have my environment under control. That's a real psychological resource. And in a small apartment, that control is both more necessary and more achievable. A large house can absorb a certain amount of chaos without feeling chaotic. A small apartment can't. The feedback loop is tighter.
Which is actually an advantage, if you think about it. In a large house, you can ignore problems for longer, and they compound. In a small apartment, the problems become visible faster, which means you address them faster.
That's the optimistic framing, and I think it's true. Small spaces force good habits because the cost of bad habits is immediately visible. There's no basement to shove things into and forget about.
What about the role of lighting? I feel like lighting gets mentioned as a small space hack, but rarely explained well.
The core principle is layered lighting, ambient, task, and accent. Ambient is the overall room light, ceiling fixtures, natural light. Task lighting is focused on specific activities, a reading lamp under cabinet kitchen lights. Accent lighting highlights specific features, art, architectural details, plants.
In a small apartment, the mistake is usually having only ambient lighting.
A single overhead light flattens the room visually. It eliminates shadows, which are actually important depth cues. Layered lighting creates pools of light and shadow that make the space feel more dimensional, and dimension reads as space. A well-lit small room with multiple light sources feels larger than the same room with a single bright ceiling fixture.
The goal isn't more light, it's more varied light.
The other thing, vertical light draws the eye up. Floor lamps that wash light up a wall or wall sconces placed at different heights create a sense of vertical space. If all your light comes from table lamps at the same height, the room feels lower and more compressed.
That's a detail I've never thought about. The height of light sources affects perceived ceiling height.
And in apartments with lower ceilings, which is a lot of older buildings, that's a cheap fix. You don't need to raise the ceiling, you just need to vary where the light comes from.
All right, let's get practical. Someone's listening to this. They live in a small apartment. They're feeling the claustrophobia Daniel described. What's the first thing they should do this weekend that isn't throw everything away?
The highest impact, lowest cost first move is a surface audit. Walk through your apartment and look at every horizontal surface. Counters, tables, dressers, shelves, windowsills. For each surface, ask, what actually lives here and what's just? The things that just ended up there, find them a home. The things that belong there, make that decision intentional. Then, clear everything else.
It's not about getting rid of stuff. It's about assigning territory.
Every item gets a postal code. And once you've done that, the 10-minute reset becomes possible because everything has a place to return to. You can't reset a space where half the items are homeless.
Homeless items become surface clutter by default because they have nowhere else to go.
Homeless items multiply because once one thing is sitting on the counter without a home, other things join it. It's the broken windows theory applied to apartment surfaces. One homeless item signals that this surface is available for random placement, and soon you've got a pile.
The surface audit is step one. What's step two?
A furniture honesty session. Look at each piece of furniture and ask, is this pulling its weight? In a small apartment, every piece of furniture should either serve a clear function or bring you genuine joy, and ideally both. That giant armchair you never sit in because it's not actually comfortable? That's not furniture, that's a storage problem you haven't identified yet.
Furniture that's just occupying space without owning its keep.
I'm not saying you have to get rid of it. You could replace it with something that does the job better or repurpose it. That armchair could become a reading nook with a side table attached, or you could swap it for a storage bench that seats two people and holds blankets. The point is to be honest about what's actually working.
What about the stuff you use, but only rarely? Holiday decorations, camping gear, formal wear? That seems like the hardest category in a small apartment.
That's where the vertical dead space we talked about really shines. High shelves, above cabinets, under the bed in sealed containers. But the other piece of advice, vacuum bags. The kind where you suck the air out with a vacuum cleaner. They can reduce the volume of soft items, winter coats, extra bedding, off-season clothes, by up to 75%.
75% volume reduction is enormous in a small apartment.
It's basically free cubic footage, and the bags themselves are cheap, maybe $20 for a pack. The only caveat is that some materials don't do well with long-term compression. Down jackets and sleeping bags lose loft if they're compressed for months, so be strategic about what goes in the vacuum bags.
What about the kitchen specifically? In my experience, the kitchen is where small apartment storage problems are most acute. You need pots and pans and utensils and dishes. You can't really get rid of them.
The kitchen is the hardest room, no question. The organizing principle that works best in small kitchens is frequency-based storage. The things you use daily, coffee maker, toaster, most used pan, primary knife, those get prime real estate, counter space, or the most accessible cabinet. Things you use weekly get the next tier. Things you use monthly or less go in the hardest to reach spots.
The spice you use once a year for that one recipe lives in the back of the highest cabinet.
That may seem obvious, but most kitchens aren't organized this way. They're organized by category, all spices together, all pots together, without regard for frequency. So you end up reaching past the daily use items to get to the occasional items, or the daily items get left out on the counter because putting them away is too annoying.
The counter becomes the home for daily items because the cabinet is inconvenient.
Then you've lost counter space to permanent residence, which makes the kitchen feel smaller and less functional. The fix is to reorganize by frequency so that putting things away is actually easier than leaving them out.
What about kitchen gadgets? I feel like small kitchens are where single-purpose gadgets go to create maximum regret.
The Yuta Taster problem. Alton Brown used to rant about this. Any kitchen tool that does only one thing needs to justify its existence aggressively. In a small apartment kitchen, the bar is even higher. If you use the garlic press every week, keep it. If you use the avocado slicer twice a year, it's taking up space that could be used by something that earns its keep daily.
The avocado slicer is a perfect example. It does exactly one thing that a knife already does perfectly well.
It's harder to clean than a knife. So it's worse on two dimensions, but I'm not telling anyone to throw away their avocado slicer. I'm saying be honest about whether it deserves the space it occupies. If your kitchen storage is maxed out and you're feeling cramped, the Unitaskers are the first place to look for space reclamation.
Let's talk about one more area that I think is a hidden source of small apartment stress, the entryway, or the lack of one. Most small apartments don't have a real entryway. You walk straight into the living area. And that transition space is where shoes, bags, keys, mail, and outerwear all converge.
The entryway problem is real, and it's especially bad in apartments where the front door opens directly into the living room or kitchen. There's no airlock, physically or psychologically. Everything from the outside world just dumps directly into your living space.
An airlock is actually a great metaphor for what a good entryway does. It's a transition zone where you process the outside before entering the inside.
In a small apartment, you have to create that airlock artificially. A narrow console table by the door with a tray for keys and wallets, a small basket for mail, hooks on the wall for bags and jackets, a shoe rack or bench with shoe storage underneath. You're essentially building a 6-square-foot entryway system that does the work of a mudroom.
The key is that everything has to be right there. If the shoe storage is down the hall, shoes will end up by the door anyway.
The system has to meet the behavior where it is, not where you wish it was. If everyone drops their bag by the door, put the bag hook by the door, don't put the bag hook in the bedroom, and then get frustrated that bags keep ending up on the floor.
Behavioral design over behavioral expectations.
That's the whole philosophy in 6 words. Design for the human you are, not the human you wish you were.
All right, I want to zoom out for a moment. We've talked about a lot of tactics. Vertical storage, zone-based organization, surface audits, the 10-minute reset, furniture choices, lighting. What's the unifying principle? If someone remembers one thing from this conversation, what should it be?
Small space living isn't about deprivation, it's about intentionality. Every cubic foot of your apartment is valuable, and you get to decide what earns that space. You don't have to own less, you have to own with purpose and store with strategy. The feeling of claustrophobia doesn't come from having too much stuff. It comes from stuff that doesn't have a home, surfaces that can't be used for their intended purpose, and visual noise that never quiets down. Fix those three things, and the square footage matters a lot less.
That's well said. The apartment feels small not because of its dimensions, but because of the friction in using it.
A well-organized 400 square feet can feel more spacious than a chaotic 800. When I was practicing medicine in Jerusalem, I did home visits for some of my patients, and I was always struck by how different the same floor plan could feel depending on how it was organized. Same building, same layout, completely different experience of space.
That's a good real-world data point. Same physical constraints, wildly different outcomes.
The people whose apartments felt larger weren't necessarily the ones with less stuff. They were the ones whose stuff had clear territory. Everything lived somewhere, and the somewhere made sense for how they actually used the item.
The goal isn't minimalism. It's legibility. You can have plenty of things as long as the system is legible to you and the people you live with.
Legibility is exactly the right word. Can you look at any surface or any storage area and understand what belongs there and what doesn't? If yes, the system works. If no, the system needs attention.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, a marine biologist in Patagonia discovered a species of jellyfish whose life cycle includes a stage where it essentially ages backwards, reverting from its adult form back to a polyp. He named it Teratopsis, derived from the Latin word for tower, because the inverted life cycle reminded him of a fortress that rebuilds itself from its own ruins.
Unexpectedly poetic for jellyfish research.
A fortress rebuilding from its own ruins. I'm going to be thinking about that for the rest of the day.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, you can find us at myweirdprompts.com. Herman, any final thought on small apartments?
Just that your space should work for you, not the other way around. And if it's not working, you can fix it without getting rid of everything you own. Small changes, consistently applied, really do add up.
We'll be back next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.